Okay. Okay, so first of all, I want to thank the organizers for letting me talk to you today. And second of all, I will subscribe to Tom's assertion that people have made fabulous introduction for these talks of the last day. That's a big advantage of talking the last day. So I'm just going to talk about briefly about a couple of historical points and motivation as to why do we even care to look for these possible intermediate mass black holes in globular clusters. So first of all, a long time ago, many decades ago, with the first X-ray observations of clusters, they found some sources that at first thought they could come from a black hole of this type. Of course, as soon as there was better resolution, they realized that it was many unresolved sources and that was no longer a plausible idea, but that's kind of what got the ball rolling in the first place. And then there were some analytical estimations of what would happen to the light distribution in clusters if there was such a black hole in there. So that was done by Bacall and Wolf a long time ago. And the thing is, at that time, there was really the instrumentation, both in the imaging and in spectroscopy, was really not to the point where those measurements could really be attempted. So for a long time, it was kind of a little bit more quiet in the field. And OK, I'm skipping a lot of work in between, but that's life. I'm sorry. So only until relatively recently, and by that I mean 10, 15 years ago, between Hubble Space Telescope going up and much better spectroscopical instruments, we could start looking into this problem. Now, why are these things important? For a variety of reasons, but it is known that there are seeds of a certain size needed to grow supermassive black holes in the centers of galaxies. Some of those black holes have been found in low luminosity AGNs, so we know that there are some of these black holes there in a different form, but the channel in which those things get put into the center of galaxies is still, and the origin of these black holes is still open. So if we figure out a way to make them or a place to put them, that would be a good thing. And, well, we need to investigate what happens with the black hole sigma, mass of the black hole sigma relation. And I'm sorry, I didn't do an underscore. How far down does it extend? And if that tells you anything, tells us anything about structure formation. So it's something to investigate. And also, if they happen to be there in certain numbers, they could matter for the estimates of gravitational wave detectors. So it would be nice to know if they're there. So the way I started getting interested in this thing had to do with work that I was doing and Holger Banwart and collaborators were doing roughly at the same time. I was measuring surface brightness profiles of globular clusters for a sample of galactic clusters with the Hubble Space Telescope. And I started finding a kind of surprising distribution of central slopes. I was expecting to get a bimodal distribution of flat cores and very steep ones in the case of the core collapse clusters or post-core collapse. And I ended up finding both for the galactic sample and for a few clusters in the LMC, SMC, around the LMC, the SMC, and the Fornax dwarf, that there are some clusters that have these shallow cusps, that's what we decided to call them, that they're not really flat, but they're not completely steep as it would be expected for core collapse. So we were just scratching our heads thinking, what is this? We have never seen this in a dynamical model. And at the same time, Holger was doing some n-body modeling of stellar clusters with black holes in them. And he found that once he projected that Bacall and Wolf cusp that was predicted from analytical models, when you project it in a relatively extended core, it looks more like that, more like those shallow cusps rather than that very steep cusp that was expected before. So we thought, oh, maybe there's... I mean, that was the only dynamical model that was kind of reproducing the things that we were observing. So we were puzzled as to... So from that on, even before that, there have been kinematical measurements taken for certain clusters. One of them being M15 has been discussed for many years, what to do with this cluster. And before we got those results with the shallow cusp and those modelings were done, because of the Bacall and Wolf estimations, people thought that the best place to look for a possibility of an intermediate mass black hole was in the very steep clusters, which is why people went for M15 at the beginning. The story and the fights have been very long on that one, so I won't stop on that one for terribly long, but there's been evidences for and against it. So I will just say that taking the kinematics and the latest dynamical models, that is the result of the latest Schwarzschild modeling of the latest kinematical measurements, and the result is that we cannot find that the evidence is there for it. The fit of the models is equally good with and without the black hole. Essentially, what is, I think anybody would agree on, regardless of the modeling, is that there is this much mass in this little very tiny radius in the center. So that's an interesting configuration for the cluster. There is a hint, but unfortunately the data is relatively, we would like to get more data on it, that there could be possible rotation at the center of this cluster, which is a very puzzling situation. So it would be really good to know if it's there, because we need to explain it with or without a black hole, if it is there. This is the latest status of M15 is, I would say, up in the air, but there's no strong evidence for the black hole in it. And I'll talk about it a bit more later. Another case that Tom just mentioned is G1. This is the very massive cluster in the Andromeda Galaxy. G1 has, because it's far away, the kinematics are not as nicely constrained as that for the galactic ones. But it shows a very clear evidence, and in this case it's unmistakable evidence for rotation, which again is it's a puzzling result in the center of a cluster. The dynamical modeling done for it has much better constraints on the best fit model is definitely one with a black hole. There have been numerical models done for these clusters in which the kinematics are matched without the need for a black hole, but these models require two smashing clusters, essentially, two clusters merging, which it could happen, but the failure of this galaxy has a very high velocity dispersion, so it's not that trivial a scenario either. For an alternative, but anyway. And then there is also the things that Tom just mentioned, the very, very supporting evidence of both the X-ray and the radio observations that really fit the bill of black hole of intermediate mass of about 10,000 solar masses being in this cluster. So as of now, this is a very solid case for a black hole in a cluster. Now, I will briefly... briefly mention the case of NGC 6752. In this case, we're not dealing with a typical kinematic data set like the ones I've been showing you. In this case, the indications come more from a very unusual millisecond pulsar population. It's unusual in the distribution of the millisecond pulsars. Although before seeing Scott Ransom's talk, I didn't realize that there was another case. Now there's one more cluster that has a configuration like this, in which there are some millisecond pulsars in the center of the cluster, in the core where it's expected, but there's also one really far out. And one possible explanation for that is that this guy got flung out. And in order to get flung out, there has to be there's a variety of possibilities to make it be flung out like that, either a binary or a binary black hole of higher mass, or a single black hole of 500 solar masses or so. So through some detailed modeling, they say that the possibility of the binary, as in just stellar binary, is relatively unlikely. So probably the possibility of a binary black hole of between 200 and 500 solar masses combined mass is probably the best possibility to explain. But besides that, I think a very interesting case for this cluster is one of those in which the millisecond pulsars allow to make very good measurements of the mass-to-light ratio in that location, that's in the very center of the cluster. And this very precise measurement, again, implies a very large amount of mass in a very small radius. So this is yet another case in which we have very firm limits on that. So now I'm going to talk about Omega Centauri. Eventually, the next talk, Jay will talk about new results that he has in this cluster. So for now, I'm going to stick to what we published last year and discuss the results in that context. And after Jay talks about his results, then I'll sort of give you the update of what that implies. So for the meantime, just stick with the results from last year. So in Omega Centauri, because it is the people have been talking a lot about the population issues that there are in that cluster, so it's a very solid candidate for being an old globular cluster with old formation, star formation history, and it could be the nuclei of an accreted galaxy. So just with that in mind, we think, okay, let's take a look at this guy because, you know, it sounds like a very interesting place to look at. Because the data, by the time we started doing this project, was coming from the Traeger et al. Compilation, and it's data from George Meillan from the 80s, this was the best we could get, those red triangles. So we figure we might as well, once we had the tools ready to measure surface brightness profiles, we might as well just get the beautiful ACS data set that it's available for OmegaSEN and measure a surface brightness profile from it. Completely expecting to get a flat core, by the way. When I measured, the surprise was, well, it kind of rises to the center. Very little. You need to see that this is a very, very shallow rise. The slope is very close to zero, actually. But anyway, it was just a possible thing. And this is a dynamical, this is the profile that we're fitting into the dynamical model. So from this profile, we can construct your basic Jeans equation-based spherical dynamical models, which are shown here. So we construct the one on the bottom is the one without a black hole, and then we put different black hole masses. And the way we obtain the kinematics for this one is these two points are coming from GMOS IFU observations in the center. So we get them from integrated spectrum fitting with a template. And these open points are coming from individual radial velocities. It's a very large data set of like 2,000 individual stars. That was very beautifully analyzed by Glenn Van de Ven, and he was very helpful through this analysis. The extra point that is here, this one is not in our paper, but I put it here just to show you. This comes, it's unpublished now, and it's not by me, it's by people working at ESO. That is from VLT Fabry-Pérot observations, AO supported. So in this case, this comes from individual radial velocities around the center of this cluster. It doesn't lie beautifully in this line, but it definitely shows evidence for an increase in velocity at the center of this cluster. So the results I'm talking about do not take this point into account for the modeling. It's just I'm showing you that new measurement is there. So, okay, from analysis like this, and also we did Schwarzschild modeling, so they are both analyses are very consistent. The best fit is about 40,000 solar masses black hole for this cluster. So we use partly the Schwarzschild modeling and partly just regular analysis to explore the alternatives to black hole models. Like what other things could make the data look like that and not be a black hole? So if we pin it all down in dark remnants, just take black holes, neutron stars, white dwarfs, whatever is kind of dark and kind of heavy, let's assume that it is on that. So you know how much you have in luminosity, you account for that, and the rest you pin it on these dark remnants, and the distribution of that would look like this. So it would look a lot. I really like the concept of a dark core that was brought up yesterday. So it would be kind of one of those, a dark core, except this is crazy in the amount of mass that it has, in how concentrated it is. It's really like decoupled, very dark, very dense mini cluster sitting at the center of this thing. And as they were saying yesterday, it's really not expected that this thing will survive for very long. We're working with Holger Bamberg to try to model these things with N-body and N-body models and try to figure out what would be the expected lifetime of such a dark cluster in the center of this of OmegaSEN, and the answer is really not very long. So it is kind of hard to maintain this stable. So from the Schwarzschild models, we can estimate, okay, so let's pin it down on anisotropy then. Let's say maybe it's not dark remnants, but what if the orbits are very strange and they mimic velocity expression rise and it's just orbital anisotropy. So if you do that very far inside the center, you need a relatively steep rise in radial anisotropy. You need the central orbits to be very radially anisotropic, which is, I don't know what you think, but I think it's a very odd configuration too. Why would you get such a configuration in a cluster like this? So anyway, so the two alternatives that we looked on, there is issues about stability about them. Like how long would they live? So we need to make solid stability tests. So very quickly, I'll just talk about a project that I've been working with Holger Baumgart, in which he gives me his N-body models. I turn them into the most realistic possible looking HST images, and analyze them the exact same way that I analyze the real data. So, okay, I'll have to really hurry to talk about more things, but it really matters the way you measure radia, break radia, core radia, whatever you want to call it. It really matters in the analysis of how you estimate things. So, measuring in different ways, we try to build this diagram in which we plot central surface brightness slope versus R. It's like RC over RH, except like for break radius, but the diagram looks the same if I use core radius. To see if, okay, what if we plot the models with and without black holes, so it's models with black holes, without black holes, and we plot the data on top of it, and let's see if we can make sort of a diagram of good candidates to follow up, and well, the answer is not really, because first of all, the data spans a much bigger area than the models do, but I think with a lot of the things that people have been saying about how to puff up clusters, we probably can, you know, with more realistic models, you can probably populate this a little better. But in any case, if there's a division line at some point for these things, it's very weak. It's not a very strong case, first of all. And second of all, we also found black hole models that lie on this area of the diagram, meaning that it doesn't always have to form a shallow cusp like the way we observe. There are cases where we have black holes and we have flat cores. So that doesn't help you much either. You really have to look everywhere, kind of. So in lieu of that, we started looking into M54. This is the globular cluster that is being discussed, if it is a nuclei of the Sagittarius dwarf that is falling into the Milky Way. So that's why it's another very interesting case to look at. We used a combination of GMOS and GNRS data. For GMOS, we mixed your regular grading with a narrow filter in a way that we could fit 700 stars in a single mask in a Gemini GMOS mask, which was amazing and very difficult to reduce. And for GNRS, we did the same type of observation as for Omega Strange, just IFU, except the wavelength is different. In this case, it's the CO band had what we used to measure kinematics. Just very quickly, I'll show you that as soon as I got the kinematics out of this, I was very surprised because I was not expecting to find such a nice regular pattern like this at all. I was expecting to measure dispersion out of it, but I never expected such a beautiful-looking rotation pattern. So if we place the center there, which is very close, it's consistent with the center that we obtained from photometry, the amplitude for the rotation is 30 kilometers a second, which is pretty high. And we can also get a dispersion measurement, taking that into account, and it's 15 kilometers per second. So, because I'm running out of time, I'll be quickly with this. We use definitely this point, but we use it in the form that I showed you, like with the rotation pattern and I'm just plotting it like that. But we use the full information to fit into the models. And the issue is because this cluster is, like I said, embedded in the Sagittarius dwarf, and there is recently very good data has been published about the measure separate the kinematics of M54 and the Sagittarius dwarf, separating with a color magnitude diagram. So they found that this is M54 and this is the Sagittarius dwarf. So they're separate. The kinematics really separate between these two. The problem is the way we set up the data, we cannot really tell between the two of them. So for our GMOS data set, where we do not separate the stars in any way, we found this, which I leave it up to you to see how consistent it is. The problem is, so we feed into the models the center point with that, the central point with that, and the central point with both, which of course the model don't like because there's like two data separate data sets. But anyway, we feed all three possibilities into the models, and the answer comes pretty much the same. The size of the chi-square changes, but the shape of this map is looking pretty much the same. And this map is showing a minimum and a black hole mass of about 10,000 solar masses. This is very preliminary work. We're definitely still working on that. But for now, there is some indication that the best fit model is better with the black hole than without, although the constraints are not as strong as we would want to. So obviously, the answer is go get more data, as usual. And the other thing is we can, again, we haven't done that analysis, but we can, again, place constraints of what are the alternative scenarios for the no black hole model. We know for now that it requires some radial anisotropy. Again, it's not as strong as in the case of Omega Sen, but it does require some radial anisotropy. So it's more and more obvious that not only we need to get better kinematics and better and throw sophisticated models at it. You cannot just stick to the basic Jeans equation. It's better if you throw Schwarzschild modeling into it. But We also need to really be able to test the stability of the alternative models, and hopefully that will give us a better idea of what to rule out and what not. So I'll leave my conclusions there very quickly. As of now, from the kinematic point of view, G1 and omega sen seem to have good indications of hosting central black holes. On the other hand, M15, I kind of forgot to mention that in this diagram that I showed you for the central surface brightness law versus RC over RH, M15 goes in there seriously ruling out region of it, and any cluster like it, the very concentrated ones, there is kind of no way to have a black hole and have them be thus as concentrated as they are. Like, the black hole will puff them up. So cases like M15 in that scenario seem like very solidly ruled out from this scenario. The preliminary best fit model that we have for M54 requires a 10 to the 4 solar massive black hole. And again, I think that I really want to pound it that stability tests are, I think, a crucial ingredient for the next step to test alternatives for the black hole models. So, thank you.